We're going to study the book of Lamentations in this section, and by way of introduction, I'll make a few comments and we'll just go right into it. This book is a sample of a genre of Hebrew literature called laments or lamentations. Lamentations or laments were a form of expressing grief and sorrow over some calamity in most cases. And virtually all of the prophets in the Old Testament have examples of this form of literature. Isaiah chapter 14 is an example of that, where we have a lament over the king of Babylon. And almost all the prophets, I think all of them except Haggai, have some examples of this form of literature. When you read a lament, especially if it's lamenting over one's own woes, you sort of get the impression that this person's wallowing in self-pity. And that's the impression you get when you read the book of Lamentations. Although, of course, the pity is not just for oneself, but for the people of God in this case. Now, some of the laments in the prophets are laments over the fall of Gentile powers. And it's not so much that the prophet is grieved over their fall, as that he's using the lament as a means of emphasizing the emotion that will be felt by those who experience it. But in this case, the writer is experiencing it himself. And who the writer is not mentioned. Traditionally, it has been understood from very ancient Jewish and Christian tradition that Jeremiah is the author, though the book is anonymous and does not claim Jeremiah or any other individual as its author. It's obviously positioned after the book of Jeremiah in our Bibles in order to reflect the tradition that Jeremiah is its author. In fact, it is treated as one of the major prophets when the major and minor prophets are categorized in Christian speech. Lamentations is considered to be one of five books of major prophets. Well, of course, Lamentations is actually shorter than several of the minor prophets. But because it is thought to belong to Jeremiah, and he is certainly a major prophet, wrote the longest prophetic book we have, it is categorized with the major prophets. Now, there seems to be more than simply tradition in favor of saying that Jeremiah is the author, though we can't be 100% certain. For one thing, the author clearly has witnessed the fall of Jerusalem. And Jeremiah at least lived at the proper time period for that. It's clear from the content of the book that it was written after the fall of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. and prior to the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the temple, which took place in 516 B.C. So sometime in that time period, somebody wrote this book. Jeremiah lived at the earlier part of this period and would most likely have had a chance to see a lot of this with his own eyes, although he and others escaped to Egypt before the final destruction happened, but he saw certainly the earlier stages and probably heard the details of the final stages of the destruction from escapees, people who fled from it, a few survivors who may have escaped to Egypt where he was, and he would have had a very clear knowledge of what had taken place. In favor of Jeremiah being the author, it is said that the vocabulary and the style of the book are very much like that found in Jeremiah, same vocabulary. We can also see a number of things within Lamentations that remind us a great deal of Jeremiah, though he's not the only person who could have said such things. For example, Lamentations 3 and verse 48, he says, "My eyes overflow with rivers of water for the destruction of the daughter of my people." It has an obvious, familiar ring to it. It's very much like Jeremiah's own words, where he said, "Oh, that my head were waters, that they might overflow with tears for the slain of the daughter of my people." Jeremiah is called the weeping prophet. One of the places, there's several places in Jeremiah, but one of the places that Jeremiah exhibits this weeping character is in Jeremiah chapter 14 and verse 17, where he says, "Therefore you shall say this word to them, let my eyes flow with tears night and day, and let them not cease, for the virgin daughter of my people has been broken with a mighty stroke, and with a very severe blow. This is fairly common in Jeremiah to talk not only about weeping, but also about the virgin daughter of my people. That expression, which is found in Lamentations 3:48, also Jeremiah 9:1. Another example of Jeremiah. Oh, that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people. So this is the language of Jeremiah, and it certainly has a familiar ring when we come to Lamentations 3:48. It says, my eyes overflow with rivers of water for the destruction of the daughter of my people. A very, very Jeremiah-like statement. Another example of where Jeremiah could easily be seen as the author is in Lamentations chapter 3, again, in verse 53, where the author says, I'll start with verse 52, my enemies without cause hunted me down like a bird. They silenced my life in the pit and threw stones at me. Now, that might be figurative. The psalmist often speaks of being confined to a pit, which usually doesn't refer to a literal pit, but just the pit of despair or a situation that is very bad. But we know Jeremiah was literally put into a pit, and for that reason, there may be a suggestion of Jeremiah being the one. Jeremiah 37:16 refers to Jeremiah being lowered into a pit, and he almost died there. Also in Lamentations chapter 4 and verse 2, it says, precious, the precious sons of Zion, valuable as fine gold. How are they regarded as clay pots, the work of the hands of the potter? This is reminiscent of the language of Jeremiah in Jeremiah chapter 18, where Israel is compared, or Jerusalem is compared, with the work of a potter. The thought is a little different, but the connection is that in both places, the people of Zion are compared with clay pots made by potter. In Jeremiah 18:4-6, it says, and the vessel that he made, as Jeremiah watched it, an actual potter at work, of clay, was marred in the hand of the potter, so he made it again into another vessel, as it seemed good to the potter to make. Then the word of the Lord came to me, saying, O house of Israel, can I not do with you as this potter, says the Lord? Look, as the clay is in the potter's hand, so are you in my hand, O house of Israel. So the idea of Israel being clay, or like a pot in the hands of the potter, is from Jeremiah, and so also in Lamentations 4:2, we have the same imagery. These are a few. As you read the book of Lamentations, having recently read Jeremiah, you may well notice far more. These are just a few examples of passages in Lamentations that would seem to give support to the tradition that Jeremiah is the author. Now, I think we might as well proceed on the assumption that Jeremiah is the author, since no other theory has been suggested that could bear some serious argument. This book is still read today, once a year, in the synagogues by the Jews. It is read on a day that is called the Ninth of Ab on the Hebrew calendar, which occurs in mid-July of our calendar. And the Ninth of Ab is the traditional date of the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. and remarkably in 70 A.D. also. Twice Jerusalem was destroyed, once by the Babylonians in 586 and once in 70 A.D. By the Romans. In both cases, the traditional date was the Ninth of Ab. Now, whether the tradition is completely true or not, you know, I don't know, but it's interesting that on the two occasions in history when Jerusalem fell, the foreign powers was destroyed and demolished, it happened on the same day of the year. And that day, as I said, is in mid-July of our calendar, and therefore the Orthodox Jews today read through aloud the book of Lamentations on that date yearly. Also, some Jews read it weekly at the in Jerusalem at the Wailing Wall. And it is also found someplace in the liturgy of the Catholic Church on certain special occasions it is read as well. The structure of the book is as follows. You can notice just by glancing through that all the chapters, except for chapter 3, have the same number of verses. They have 22 verses. chapters 1 and 2, and then again 4 and 5, each have 22 verses. Chapter 3 has exactly 3 times as many verses, 66 verses. Now, you may be aware from your studies in the Psalms that some of the Psalms are what we call acrostics. They are Psalms that have either 22 or 44 verses, usually. And there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet. And the Psalms that are written as acrostics, if they are 22 verses long, usually have each verse begins with a successive letter of the alphabet in Hebrew. So that you run through the whole alphabet, each verse successively beginning with a different letter of the alphabet in alphabetical order. In the case of the Psalms that have 44 or 66 verses, which are written in acrostic form, generally you'll have 2 verses or 3 verses with the first letter, then 2 or 3 verses with the second letter, and so forth. There is the one well-known acrostic in Psalm 119 that has 8 verses beginning with each letter. Psalm 119, as you know, is arranged in sets of 8 verses each, and each set of 8 has one of the successive letters of the Hebrew alphabet at the head, and all the verses in each set begins in the Hebrew Bible with that letter. So this is a style of poetry that the Hebrew writers frequently employ to move through their alphabet in an acrostic style in giving an oracle. Now in the case of these laments in this book, each chapter of the first 4 exactly, and the 5th is an exception, but the first 4 chapters are acrostics. And that means chapters 1 and 2 and 4 each have one verse beginning with the successive letter of the alphabet. There's 22 verses, 22 letters. Chapter 3, which has 3 times as many verses, has 3 verses each for each letter. And then the 5th chapter, though it has 22 verses also, it does not follow strict acrostic. So we wouldn't get that, of course, reading it in the English, but the author has organized his thoughts. You read in the book of Lamentations a tremendous amount of emotion and passion, and you might get the impression that it was spontaneously blurted out in agony, but as a matter of fact, it's been carefully arranged. His thoughts no doubt have sincere emotion, but he did arrange them in this present arrangement around a set pattern, which is carefully worked out around the alphabet of the Hebrew language. I would point out also that the first 3 chapters really are of equal length, even though the 3rd chapter has 66 verses and chapters 1 and 2 have 22, each verse is 3 times as long in the first 2 chapters. You'll notice, well, you won't notice it so much in the English, but you can even notice it a bit in the English, that the verses in chapters 1 and 2 are quite long, whereas in chapter 3, the verses are very short. They're actually one-third as long. In the Hebrew, the verses in chapters 1 and 2 are 3 lines long, and the verses in chapter 3 are only 1 line long. Now, interestingly, in chapter 4, each verse is 2 lines long, which is neither like chapter 2 nor chapter 3. Each verse in the Hebrew in chapter 4 is 2 lines long, and in chapter 5, which is not an acrostic, each verse again is 1 line long, as is the case in chapter 3. So what you have is the first 2 chapters, each verse is very long, and then in chapter 3, you have 3 times as many verses, but they're 1/3 as long. So the total length of the chapter is the same length, same number of lines in the Hebrew. And then chapters 4 and 5 diminish in length, 22 verses each, but in each case, shorter verses. 2 lines in chapter 4 per verse, and 1 line per verse in chapter 5. This probably has nothing to do with the spiritual value of the book, but it is something that may be a point of interest, and something you would certainly not get from, you might not notice reading it in English, but it would be interesting when, for instance, the original reader is reading it in Hebrew. And all I can say, as far as the significance, is that it does bear witness to a certain plan and orderliness to the writing of it, rather than a spontaneous crying out, as one might get the impression otherwise, takes place. Yet, It would appear that the emotion in the book is very genuine, and probably it's very possible that a rough draft of the material was written that was not so well arranged, and then later Jeremiah, or possibly someone else, took what was more of a spontaneous cry and arranged it in this more poetic way, around this acrostic structure. And that would possibly be for the sake of liturgical reading or whatever. Anyway, in the Hebrew, the name of the book is the Hebrew word for how. And this is for the same reason that the Genesis is in the Hebrew Bible called in the beginning. And Exodus is now these are the names and so forth, because the Hebrew Bible frequently gives us the title of the book, simply the first word or phrase of the book. And the first word in chapter 1 is how. By the way, that's also the case with chapters 2 and 4. They also begin with the word how. But mainly because chapter 1 begins with that word, the book is called how in Hebrew. Okay, not much more needs to be said. We'll just get right into it. Each of the five chapters is a separate lament. And in other words, it's not a running lament of five chapters length, but the five may have been written on separate occasions. The fact that each is set as an individual acrostic would indicate that they that each one is a unit. Each chapter is a unit in itself, and they may not all just flow at one time from the author. How lonely sits the city that was full of people? How like a widow is she who was great among the nations? The princes among the provinces, I'm sorry, the princess among the provinces has become a slave. Now, in the typical form of Hebrew poetry, we see repetition. This is one of the main characteristics of Hebrew poetry. Basically, there's one thought stated three times. It's not exactly the same in each case, but there's a clear relation. She that was full of people is now lonely. She that was great among the nations is now a widow, which corresponds with lonely. Widows are lonely. She that was once the princess among the provinces has now become a slave. And so we're not going to note this in all the verses, although you can. I mean, most of the verses will have this parallel structure, but just at the beginning, I'd like you to be aware that this has the regular characteristic of Hebrew poetry of usually having couplets, or in this case, triplets, of sayings that basically express the same point. And it talks about the city as a widow. It reminds us that Israel was considered to be, and particularly Jerusalem, the capital, was to be seen as God's wife. But now it's as if God has died. It's really more properly that they have died, but they're left without a husband. God has abandoned them. And Jeremiah himself spoke that way in chapters 2 and 3 of Jeremiah, about not so much of them being a widow, but being a divorcee, that their husband had left them alone. That he had divorced them because of their spiritual immorality, their spiritual adultery. Verse 2, she weeps bitterly in the night, her tears are on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. Judah has gone into captivity, under affliction and hard servitude. She dwells among the nations. She finds no rest. All her persecutors overtake her in dire straits. In this case, the first two lines of this verse are parallel. Gone into captivity parallels dwelling among the nations. Being afflicted under hard servitude parallels finding no rest. The third line is sort of a different thought. The roads to Zion mourn because no one comes to the set feast. All her gates are desolate. Her priests sigh. Her virgins are afflicted, and she is in bitterness. The personification of the roads to Zion and their mourning is because they've been accustomed several times a year to accommodating pilgrims from all over the world, Jewish people who have come to Jerusalem to celebrate Passover and Pentecost and Tabernacles on regular set occasions, but now no one's going to Jerusalem. There's nothing there. There's nothing to go there for. The Jews are in other countries, but they can't make pilgrimages to Jerusalem. They're not at liberty. Furthermore, even if they were at liberty, there's no Jerusalem to make a pilgrimage to. It's all rubble. And so the roads are lonely, as it were. The roads are desolate because the pilgrims no longer come to the set feast. 5. Her adversaries have become her master. Her enemies prosper. For the Lord has afflicted her because of the multitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone into captivity before the enemy. And from the daughter of Zion, all her splendor has departed. The glory has departed. Her princes have become like deer that find no pasture, that flee without strength before the pursuer. The enemies, of course, almost always would target the leaders, princes and nobility, first to be captured. Because once they've captured kings and their families and so forth, there was really no strength left for a city or a nation to resist. And so it speaks of the hunting down of the princes, which the Babylonians did, apparently, like the hunting of wildlife. In the days of her affliction and roaming, Jerusalem remembers all her pleasant things that she had in the days of old, when her people fell into the hands of the enemy with no one to help her. The adversaries saw her and mocked her at her downfall. It made their captivity the more bitter to remember how much blessing and prosperity they once had. It's always harder when you fall into calamity if you can remember good old days, days that are gone and irretrievable. If your life has always been hard and you've always been poor, then further poverty and hardship don't really seem to be too strange. But when you've known the blessing of God, and when you've, it's like the psalmist that said, you know, when I remember, when I used to go to the house of the Lord with songs of praise and so forth, it grieved him because he was now in exile at the time he wrote one of those songs. And he remembered the times when he was able to go to the house of God, and just remembering those better days made the present bitterness the more bitter. Jerusalem has sinned grievously. Therefore she has become vile. All who honor her despise her, because they have seen her nakedness. Yes, she sighs and turns away. Now, the writer, for the most part, acts like he's, you know, indulging in self-pity and pity for his people, as if for some strange reason they just suffered calamity. And he calls for vindication, and he calls for judgment, as we'll see, on those who have oppressed her. Yet, he acknowledges in some places that she deserved it. Although he wants her persecutors to be judged, he admits in many cases that they were really instruments of just retribution upon Jerusalem. Here, we see in verse 8, she sinned grievously, which is the reason that these things have happened to her. Only occasionally does this come up, but it's important to see it, that the writer is not suggesting that some injustice has really happened to Jerusalem. What has happened was well deserved, but it's still sad. Jesus knew in his day that Jerusalem was going to fall to the Romans, and it would be well deserved. He said it was going to happen to them because they did not recognize the day of their visitation in Luke chapter 19. But he also wept over the city because, though it was well deserved, it was a tragedy and a sad thing. Her uncleanness is in her skirts. She did not consider her destiny. Therefore, her collapse was awesome. She had no comforter. O Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy has magnified himself. In verse 9, it says she did not consider her destiny. Therefore, her collapse was awesome. It's rather significant, rather interesting, because Jerusalem had a destiny in God, if they had lived up to it, to be a glorious light to the nations and the preserver of the knowledge of God for the world. That was her destiny. But because she never appreciated her destiny, she kind of fell into misbehavior. Instead of seeing herself as that which would be the leader of the nations, she followed the nations into their corruption and idolatry. I think it's obvious that Christians also are in danger if they don't understand what the church is for and what its destiny is, of just losing the divine character that he has, that God has put into the church, and following the world and imitating the world. If we understand the destiny of the church, then we will guard against the desire to drag down or collapse the church or cave in the church to the pressure of becoming like the world. 10. The adversary has spread his hand over all her pleasant things. For she has seen the nations enter her sanctuary, meaning the temple. The Gentiles have come in where they ought not to be, and they've destroyed the temple. those who you commanded not to enter your congregation. All her people sigh. They seek bread. They have given their valuables for food to restore life. Steal, Lord, and consider, for I am scorned. An apparent reference to famine, probably during the siege of Jerusalem was for a while before it fell. And while we don't read in the accounts of 2 Kings or Chronicles, I don't think we read in those passages of cannibalism or the straits to which people were brought to in the famine, we read of them here. Jeremiah is describing what happened in 586 and prior to that in the famine and the siege, and he will mention twice in this book cannibalism, people eating their own children. Now this is something that Moses said in Deuteronomy would happen. In Deuteronomy 28, he told the Jews if they departed from the covenant and made God angry with them, that he would reduce them to these conditions, that their enemies would besiege them, they'd starve, they'd eat their own children. And we have it from Josephus. Josephus recorded cases where this happened in 70 AD in the siege, that people ate their own children in the siege. We have it in an earlier story, in the days of Elisha, that Samaria was under siege from the Syrians, and it is known that a woman ate her child. In fact, two women conspired together. They would eat one's child that day and the other one's the next day. And so a woman agreed and her child was eaten, and the next day the second woman wouldn't surrender her child, and so she complained to the king. And when he learned of it, he tore his robes, and he was very grieved to find out that things had become so bad that people were eating their children. There's at least, apparently, three times in Jewish history when the capital cities were either Samaria or Jerusalem were under such grievous famine because of siege that they ate their children. Now, Lamentations, I believe, is the only place in the Old Testament that tells us that this also happened in 586 B.C. We haven't come to those verses yet, but there is mention of shortage of food, which later led to such horrible atrocities as cannibalism. But in verse 11, he says, they seek bread and have, they've given their valuables for food just to sustain their life. It suggests, of course, that in times of great famine, people give up things, diamonds, valuables, you know, things that are normally worth hundreds or thousands of dollars just for a piece of bread to survive. Verse 12, Is it nothing to you, all who pass by? Behold and see, if there is any sorrow like my sorrow, which has been brought on me, which the Lord has inflicted on me in the day of his fierce anger. Now here, particularly, it sounds like sort of wallowing in self-pity. No one has suffered like I've suffered, is suggested. Well, the fact of the matter is, probably most of the other nations that were destroyed by Babylon would feel the same way about themselves. You know, I mean, now this may be literally true. It may be that the afflictions on Jerusalem were greater than those that Babylon inflicted on some of the other nations they conquered. But I would imagine any other nation reading this would say, hey, well, you should see what they did to us, you know. But Jerusalem, of course, it was more galling to them to be destroyed by heathen, because they knew that they were supposed to be God's people and that the gods and heathen were no gods at all, and yet this made it look as if their gods were their God was impotent in the face of those who served other gods. And probably that added to their suffering. Besides the physical suffering, there was the humiliation and perhaps the sense of guilt that their sins had brought upon God a reproach, that they had, as it were, made it seem by bringing this upon themselves that God was not a great God after all. And so they bore suffering on more than one level, including the guilt of their conscience that they had brought this reproach on the Lord. And that would be in addition to their physical woes. Verse 13, from above he has sent fire into my bones, and it overpowered them. He has spread a net for my feet and turned me back. He has made me desolate and faint all the day. That is, the Lord has. The yoke of my transgressions was bound. They were woven together by his hands. And the thrust upon my neck, he made my strength fail. The Lord delivered me into the hands of those whom I'm not able to withstand. The Lord has trampled underfoot all my mighty men in my midst. He has called an assembly against me to crush my young men. The Lord trampled as in a winepress the virgin daughter of Judah. The trampling of Judah as in a winepress is an image that comes up again in the book of Revelation. And in fact, we might just take a sneak preview of that. Because Revelation, you know, there's a variety of ways of interpreting. We'll survey several of them. But there is a view that, to my mind, it warrants consideration, that sees Revelation as a prediction of the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Of course, that view, which is called the preterist view, requires that Revelation be written before 70 AD, and many scholars do not believe that it was written that early. But there are many scholars who believe that it was. And if Revelation was predicting the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, then a passage like Revelation 14 would be best understood in light of this imagery taken from Lamentations. It says in verse 17 of Revelation 14, "Then another angel came out of the temple, which is in heaven, also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar who had power over fire, and he cried aloud to cry unto them who had the sharp sickle, saying, Thrust in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, or it could be of the land. For her grapes are fully ripe. So the angel thrust his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth, or of the land," equally translatable that way, "and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trampled outside the city. The blood came out of the winepress up to the horse's bridles for 1,600 furlongs." 1,600 furlongs is the distance, the actual distance, from the northern to the southern boundary of Israel. So it seems to speak of a calamity upon Israel. But it's interesting that this is described as a harvesting of the vine. We know that that's an image of Israel in the Old Testament and the New, in Jesus' parable of the vineyard. And it is throwing the winepress of God's wrath, and he tramples it. This image is found here in Lamentations 1:15, where it says, "The Lord has trampled as in a winepress the virgin daughter of Judah." And it would seem that Revelation 14 is just echoing this sentiment, the difference being that Lamentations is considering 586 B.C., and Revelation may be considering 70 A.D. But we know very much it is similar between those two things. In fact, one could arguably be said to be a type of the other. "For these things I weep. My eye overflows with water." Again, sounds like Jeremiah. "Because the Comforter, who should restore my life, is far from me. My children are desolate because the enemy prevailed." One of the things that makes suffering even greater is seeing your own children suffering. Many people can heroically endure personal poverty and suffering, but to see their children endure the same is more than they can bear. And there's a number of places in this Lamentations that speaks of the suffering of children, which is perhaps one of the more severe tortures that the people are put to, is to see their children suffer in these ways. "Zion spreads out his hands," that is in prayer, "but there's no one to comfort her." God's not listening. "The Lord has commanded concerning Jacob that those around him become his adversaries. Jerusalem has become an unclean thing among them." You know, the people of Zion call out to God in their distress, spray their hands, pray to God, but God's not paying attention. In fact, their distress is something God has commanded to come upon them. They're asking in vain, because the Lord has commanded that those around him become his adversaries. "For they came, the Lord is righteous, for I rebelled against his commandment." Another example of the prophet acknowledging the guilt and the propriety of these things happening upon them. God is not unjust to bring such things upon them. "Hear now, all peoples, and behold my sorrow. My virgins and my young men have gone into captivity. I called for my lovers, but they deceived me. My priests and my elders breathed their last in the city, while they chopped food to restore their lives." Apparently, a reference to the people actually starving in the famine of the sea. "See, O Lord, that I am in distress. My soul is troubled. My heart is overturned within me, for I have been very rebellious. Outside the sword bereaves. At home, it is like death. They have heard that I died, with no one to comfort me. All my enemies have heard of my trouble. They are glad that you have done it. Bring on the day that you have announced, that they may become like me," that is, that the enemies will become like us, that is, destroyed. We've been destroyed. quickly bring about the time that you have predicted that they will be destroyed. Habakkuk and some of the other prophets, Habakkuk was, of course, contemporary with Jeremiah, had predicted the destruction of Babylon. So did Jeremiah, by the way, in the latter chapters. And so this is the day of Babylon's destruction is the day that God has announced. He says, bring it quickly, judge them quickly. It's an imprecation upon them. Make them like me. That is, let them endure and suffer the things that we've had to endure and suffer. Let all their wickedness come before you, and do to them as you have done to me, for all my transgressions, and for my sighs are many, and my heart is faint. Okay, chapter 2. How the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger. He cast down from heaven to the earth the beauty of Israel, and did not remember his footstool in the day of his anger. Now, I just want to comment on this cloud business. God has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger. God's wrath and judgment is described as a cloud cover, which of course would darken the skies. It'll become evident in studying the prophets and even the New Testament that when judgment upon a city is predicted or announced, that it is often spoken of as a time of the darkening of the sun and the moon and the stars, and sometimes even figuratively of the stars falling from heaven. Though this could be, strictly speaking, symbolic, it may be in some sense literal, too, that when things were burned, clouds of smoke darkened the sky and obscured the view of the sun and the moon and the stars, so it could be said the sun, the moon, and the stars were darkened over them. And we find this said in Isaiah 13, chapter 15, verse 10, where it speaks of the fall of Babylon, that the sun and the moon will be darkened and the stars will not give their light. We find it also in other passages in Isaiah and in Ezekiel and in Joel, where the destruction of various cities or empires are described, and the result, or at least one of the results mentioned, is that there will be a darkening of the sun and moon and stars. Now, that can be very figurative, but it could also be a reference to, again, the smoke of destruction and burning, blotting out the view of the sky. We see in in Ezekiel, chapter 32, a prophecy about the fall of Egypt, or the destruction of Egypt by the Babylonians. And he says, in Ezekiel 32, 7 and 8, when I put out your light, I will cover the heavens and make the stars dark. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon shall not give her light. All the bright lights of the heavens, this is Ezekiel 32, 7 and 8, all the bright lights of the heavens I will make dark over you, and bring darkness upon your land, says the Lord God. Now, one reason I stress this is because this imagery of a nation coming under judgment and therefore all the bright lights of heaven being made dark over it is used also in the New Testament, and unfortunately some people have read into it the end of the world, because they thought that what is being predicted here is the literal destruction of the sun and the moon and the stars, where that's not necessarily implied at all. In Matthew 24, for example, in Matthew 24, verse 29, in a passage that I believe describes the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, it says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. If you'll turn over to Acts chapter 2, where Peter is quoting from Joel, and says, this is the fulfillment of that on the day of Pentecost. It's rather interesting. He quotes Joel further than some people think he should have. When Peter is trying to explain what has happened in the upper room, in Acts chapter 2, beginning with verse 15, because these are not drunk, as you suppose, since it's only the third hour of the day. But this is what was spoken by the prophet Joel. Now, there's a somewhat lengthy quote from the book of Joel in the second chapter. He says, if it shall come to pass in the last days, says God, that I will pour out of my spirit on all flesh, your sons, your daughters shall prophesy, your young men shall see visions, your old men shall dream dreams, and on my maidservants and men servants I will pour out of my spirit in those days, and they shall prophesy. I will show wonders in heaven above, and signs in the earth beneath, blood and fire and vapor of smoke, or some modern translation say pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned to darkness, the moon into blood, before the coming of the great and notable day of the Lord. And it shall come to pass that whoever calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. Now I bring this up because verses 17 and 18 clearly refer to the day of Pentecost, the pouring out of the Spirit on all flesh. And Peter says that's what it is. But then he also continues the quote through, you know, verses 19 and 21 to discuss something that does not appear to refer to the day of Pentecost, which many people think is the end of the world, where he says, I will show wonders in heaven above and signs on the earth beneath, blood and fire, pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned to darkness, the moon to be blood, before the coming of the day of the Lord. But why would Peter quote a passage about the end of the world on this occasion where he's saying, this is that? As if it's immediately facing, fulfillment. This is 2,000 years ago he quoted this and said, this is what Joel spoke about. If, however, we understand his use of the term last days in verse 17 to mean the last days of the Jewish economy, then what he has in view is that God is pouring out his Spirit as a precursor to sending judgment on Jerusalem, which came in 70 AD. And this would be agreeable with what John the Baptist said. John the Baptist said that Jesus would come with a double baptism, a baptism with the Holy Spirit and with fire. The one would come upon the believers, the other on the unbelievers. The baptism of fire would be the fiery destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. You've heard me say that before, though I don't know if you remember my reasons for taking it that way. We can't go into it right now. But it would make perfectly good sense then for Peter to quote this if this latter description of verses 19 through 21 is talking about 70 AD, and well it might. Because it says there'd be fire and blood, there certainly was both in 70 AD, and pillars of smoke, and the sun being turned to darkness and the moon to blood. This, if you've lived in Los Angeles or any place where there's a lot of smoke in the air, or soot, or smog, you've seen many times the night, the moon is blood red. I mean, it looks red because of you're seeing it through the soot, you're seeing it through the smog. And sometimes the clouds can be so thick that you can't see the sun at all. And that could be quite literally the case, although there's much apocalyptic imagery too to be considered. There's no reason why Peter's statements can't refer to 70 AD. In fact, it's most likely they would, since he says this is that. This is the process of the fulfillment of that prophecy. And anyway, of course, this could take us off on a tangent, which we can't afford to take. But I bring this all up because of Lamentations 2:1. Where the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC is said to be characterized by God covering the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger, which would, of course, on a cloudy day or a cloudy night, you can't see the sun or the moon or the stars, and it's the same kind of imagery. The cloud is a cloud of his anger, but it may well refer to the clouds of smoke that occurred when Jerusalem was burned by the Babylonians. But then he cast down from the heaven. It's rather obviously not literal because Israel never was up into heaven. And to cast down from heaven to earth is something that is a figurative expression of casting down from a pinnacle of privilege and splendor down to, shame and contempt and disaster. Now, by the way, the same thing is said of Capernaum by Jesus. When he weeps, he doesn't exactly weep, I guess, but he does speak imprecations or something like that against Capernaum and Chorazin. But in Matthew 11:23, Jesus says, "And you, Capernaum, who are exalted into heaven, will be brought down to Hades. For if the mighty works which were done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained the same." Notice he says Capernaum is exalted into heaven. Not literally, of course. Figuratively. But will be brought down to Hades. Just a figure of speech, of course. But we have a similar thing said about Edom in the book of Obadiah. A very short book, only one chapter, right after the book of Amos. And Obadiah verses 3 and 4, it is said about Edom, which of course was destroyed in pre-Christian times, "The pride of your heart has deceived you. You who dwell in the clefts of the rock," meaning the rock city of Petra, their capital, "whose habitation is high, you who say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? Though you exalt yourself as high as the eagle, And though you set your nest among the stars, from there I will bring you down, says the Lord. Now the reason I point these things out is because we need to be familiar with the imagery the prophets use so we don't misinterpret certain passages. And one passage that has been very much misinterpreted, to my mind, by the failure to recognize this kind of imagery is Isaiah 14 in the passage about Lucifer. Because, as you know, Lucifer has traditionally been identified with an angel in, you know, traditional theology. But the only place that he's mentioned in the Bible is in Isaiah 14:12, and then only in the King James and the New King James, because the other versions just translate the word Lucifer as son of the morning or star of the morning or something like that. But the reason that some have felt that Lucifer is a superhuman being, although the evidence from the context is Lucifer is just another term used to denote the king of Babylon, is because of what it says in verses 13 and following. Isaiah 14:13 says, "For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I also will sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest side of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High." Then verse 15 says, "Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol," or hell, "to the lowest depths of the pit." Some say, well, no human being could make such claims as this. This must be an angel or someone like that. But they fail to recognize that when he says, "I will ascend into heaven, I'll exalt my throne above the stars of God," these are the exact same words said of Edom. "Though you set your throne above the stars of God, yet you'll be brought down." Or of Capernaum, "Though you be exalted into heaven, you'll be brought down to hell." The very same words. And even in Lamentations 2, it speaks of the condition of Israel before she fell, or Judah before she fell, as being in heaven. It says, "And God has cast you down from heaven to the earth." It's just a figure of speech, of course. But we recognize it as a figure of speech in all other places. The important thing is that we don't forcibly and artificially take it literally in the case of Lucifer, as if to preclude the possibility of Lucifer being merely the king of Babylon. What is said of Edom and Capernaum and Jerusalem could also be said of Babylon in that respect. Okay, let's go on. Lamentations 2:2. "The Lord has swallowed up and has not pitied all the inhabitants of Jacob. He has thrown down in his wrath the strongholds of the daughter of Judah. He has brought them down to the ground. He has profaned the kingdom of and its princes. He has cut off in fierce anger every horn of Israel," which the horn in Hebrew poetry usually refers to power, normally political or military power, so it may just refer to the armies, or it may refer to the powerful individuals. Every horn in Israel has been cut down. "He has drawn back his right hand from before the enemy. He has blazed against Jacob like a flaming fire which devours all around. Standing like an enemy, he has bent his bow. With his right hand like an adversary, he has slain all who were pleasing to his eye." He's not really saying that the people who were truly pleasing to God were slain. After all, Jeremiah is an example of the remnant who were really pleasing to God who were not slain. He's speaking of the people of Judah in general as those that God had formerly treated with deference, that he had treated them as those that he had pleasure in. He had blessed that nation previously, and now he's shot at them. That's what he's saying. He's not making reference to individuals who truly have pleased him. More, he's speaking figuratively of the nation was once a nation pleasing to him, and now he's taking his vengeance on them for their sins. "On the tent of the daughter of Zion, he has poured out his fury like fire." Verse 5. "The Lord was like an enemy. He has swallowed up Israel. He has swallowed up all her palaces. He has destroyed her strongholds and has increased mourning and lamentation in the daughter of Judah. He has done violence to his tabernacle, as if it were a garden. He has destroyed his place of assembly," that is, the temple. "The Lord has caused the appointed feasts and Sabbaths to be forgotten in Zion. In his burning indignation, he has spurned the king and the priest. The Lord has spurned his altar. He has abandoned his sanctuary," again referring to the temple there. "He has given up the walls of her palaces into the hand of the enemy. They have made a noise in the house of the Lord as on a day of set feast." On the set feasts, the Jews would usually make a lot of noise of singing and celebration and partying and so forth, and feasting. Now, Jeremiah is aware of noises in the same region, where the feasting usually was taking place, but of a very different sort. A cry of victory on the part of the oppressors who busted through the walls and taken the sanctuary. The Lord has purposed to destroy the wall of the daughter of Zion. He has stretched out a line. He has not withdrawn his hand from destroying. Therefore, he has caused the rampart and the wall to lament. They languish together. Her gates have sunk into the ground. He has destroyed and broken her bars. Her kings and her princes are among the nations. The law is no more, and her prophets find no vision from the Lord. One of the ways that God exhibited his displeasure in judgment was that he would no longer speak to the prophets. Now, he spoke to Jeremiah at this time, and apparently Habakkuk and Zephaniah, but they were no longer heard. When Jerusalem fell, no one was listening to them. I mean, the prophets were no longer basically heard by the majority of them anyway. When it says her prophets find no vision of the Lord, it's probably a reference mostly to the professional prophets. There were a few true prophets like Ezekiel who prophesied to the exiles in Babylon and Daniel. But there were professional prophets, as we know, who even resisted Jeremiah. When Jeremiah put the yoke on him, one of the professional prophets broke the yoke and said, this is how the yoke of Babylon is going to be broken and so forth. They were false prophets. But the law is no more. Of course, doesn't mean that the law has been abrogated at that time, but rather that it no longer is being practiced. The law required certain festivals and sacrifices to be observed. Without a temple, you can't do that. And so it's as if the law had ceased to be practiced and that God was not speaking to the people anymore through prophets, at least through the phony prophets. They weren't even claiming to have visions anymore. The elders of the daughter of Zion sit on the ground and keep silence. Sitting on the ground as opposed to on their thrones suggests humility or just total humiliation, more like. They throw dust on their heads and gird themselves with sackcloth. The virgins of Jerusalem bow their heads to the ground. My eyes fail with tears. My heart is troubled. My bile is poured out on the ground because of the destruction of the daughter of my people, because the children and the infants faint in the streets of the city, probably meaning for lack of food. They say to their mothers, where is grain and wine? As they swoon like wounded in the streets of the city, as their life is poured out, even in their mother's bosom. The life of an infant being poured out, or ebbing away, even while they're being held at their mother's breast, is fairly familiar to us in our time because of the graphic pictures we've seen not too many years ago of problems in Ethiopia, and before that in Biafra, and other places where you see pictures of women, you know, and starving babies at their breasts because their breasts, the women themselves have no food and they have nothing to give to the babies. That apparently was part of the result of the famine also in Jerusalem. How shall I console you? So what shall I liken you, O daughter of Jerusalem? What shall I compare with you that I may comfort you, O virgin daughter of Zion? For your ruin is spread wide as the sea. Who can heal you? Again, the healing motif, the sickness motif, the condition of being under God's judgment was what is considered to be sickness, and there was no one who could heal the nation at that point. Your prophets have seen for you false and deceptive visions. They have not uncovered your iniquity. That is, they have not exposed your sin. False prophets generally said what you want to hear. True prophets were sent usually to expose the sins of the people and to warn of judgment. The false prophets did not uncover their iniquity. That is, they did not expose sin, and therefore they gave false and deceptive visions to bring you back. They did not expose your iniquity to bring back your captives, but have envisioned for you false prophecies and delusions. Was that a hand up from Crystal? Did you hear that? All who pass by clap their hands at you. They hiss and shake their heads at the daughter of Jerusalem. Is this the city that is called the perfection of beauty, the joy of the whole earth? The joy of the whole earth and the perfection of beauty is a term for Jerusalem that we find in Psalm 48. In verse 2, you may know verses 1 and 2 because it has long been sung in Christian circles. It's great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, meaning Jerusalem, in the mountain of his holiness, meaning Zion. Beautiful for situation, which means beautifully located. The joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion. On the side of the north, the city of the great king. The joy of the whole earth was a term that was used 4. And here also in Lamentations 2:15, is this the thing that was called the perfection of beautiful beauty and the joy of the Holy Earth? By the way, again, earth could be translated land. I don't know that it was ever thought that Jerusalem was rejoicing by all the people of the earth, all the nations. After all, most of the nations of the earth were fairly oblivious to Israel most of the time. Although there were Jews scattered throughout the earth, and therefore in most of the countries there were people who rejoiced in Jerusalem and made pilgrimages to Jerusalem. But it's also entirely possible that joy of the whole earth should be translated joy of the whole land of Israel. That is, all of Israel looked to Jerusalem as the place of rejoicing and feasting and worship. All your enemies have opened their mouths against you. They hiss and gnash their teeth. They say, "We have swallowed her up. Surely this is the day we have waited for. We have found it. We have seen it," say to her enemies. "The Lord has done what he purposed. He has fulfilled his word, which he commanded in days of old. He has thrown down and he has not pitied. He has caused your enemy to rejoice over you. He has exalted the horn of your adversaries. Their heart cried out to the Lord. O wall of the daughter of Zion, let tears run down like a river day and night. Give yourself no relief. Give yourself no rest. Arise, cry out in the night, at the beginnings of the watches. Pour out your heart like water before the face of the Lord. Lift your hands toward him for the life of your young children, who faint from hunger at the head of every street. See, O Lord, and consider, to whom have you done this? Should the women eat their offspring, the children that they have cuddled? Should the priest and the prophet be slain in the sanctuary of the Lord? Young and old lie on the ground in the streets. My virgins and my young men have fallen by the sword. You have slain them in the day of your anger. You have slaughtered and not pitied. You have invited us to a feast day, the terrors that surround me. In the day of the Lord's anger, there was no refugee or survivor. Those whom I have born and brought up, my enemies have destroyed." Those my own children that I bore and brought up have been destroyed by the enemies too. He compares the terrors that came upon, of course meaning the invading army, as those that have been invited to a feast, to feast on Jerusalem, that is. It's as if God invited them to a feast. You know, Jesus told a parable in Matthew 22 of a wedding feast. And he said a king wanted to make a wedding for his son. And he sent out messengers to invite people to the feast. And the first people invited, apparently in the parable, represent the Jews. And they made excuses and didn't come. And it says he was wroth with them and he sent his armies and destroyed their city. A reference to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. This is Matthew 22, the first parable in that chapter. Then it says, then he sent out his messengers to the highways and byways, apparently representing the Gentiles, and compelled them to come in. And then the feast was first with guests. But it's interesting, there's two feasts, as it were. Here is the feast where the people of the Gentiles come and feast on Jerusalem. But there's also the feast of salvation that people are invited to. And the Jews who rejected the feast of salvation, that refused to come invited into the kingdom of God to receive Christ, they had to participate in as the hors d'oeuvres of the feast of the wicked that came against them. Likewise in Revelation 19, we read of two feasts, and the same contrast is made. One, the feast, the wedding feast of the Lamb, wedding supper of the Lamb. The other is a feast of carnivorous birds coming to eat the wicked who have been slain. We see, for example, in Revelation 19:9, "Then he said to me, Write, blessed are those who are called to the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said to me, These are the true sayings of God." But then, in verse 17 of the same chapter, Revelation 19:17, "Then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds that fly in the midst of heaven, Come and gather yourself together for the supper of the great God, that you may eat the flesh of kings, and the flesh of captains, and the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses, and those who sit on them, the flesh of all people, free and slave, both small and great." So we have two feasts beginning contrast. Come to the feast of the Lamb, or be feasted upon by the vultures, as it were. And if Revelation is talking about the fall of Jerusalem in 70 AD, as some believe, and could be well argued, then it would be saying a similar thing. If they don't come to the wedding feast, then they will be part of the feast of the king sending his armies to destroy their city, and the vultures will eat them. And so also, when Jerusalem fell in 586 BC, the prophet likened it to the people being feasted on. Chapter 3 then, there's the I and me seen throughout this section that almost suggests the prophet would be thinking about himself, and it can sound like he is, but in all likelihood he's personifying the nation and speaking as a representative of the nation. So it's like the nation is speaking in a first person singular. Though later on, at about verse 52, there's some reason to believe that maybe the prophet's speaking for himself. It's not all that clear. But at least some of this is not speaking about himself so much as about the nation itself. I am the man who has seen affliction by the rod of his wrath, of God's wrath. He has led me and made me walk in darkness and not in light. Surely he has turned his hand against me time and time again throughout the days. He has aged my flesh and my skin and broken my bones. He has besieged me, which sounds more like a city speaking than an individual, and surrounded me with bitterness and woe. He has set me in dark places like the dead of long ago. He has hedged me in so that I cannot get out. He has made my chain heavy. Even when I cry and shout, he shuts out my prayer. He has blocked my ways with hewn stone. He has made my paths crooked. He has been to me like a bear lying in wait, like a lion in ambush. He's saying God has been like that, although in the book of Jeremiah, Babylon is called a lion, or Nebuchadnezzar is called a lion, crouching and coming against Jerusalem. See, Jerusalem is likened in the scripture to God's flock of sheep. The enemies of Jerusalem, or of Israel, the Gentiles, are usually compared to carnivorous beasts that are the typical enemies of sheep. Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar himself is likened unto a lion in the book of Jeremiah, although here it's the Lord has been like a lion tearing at the flock instead of like a shepherd, because they're no longer his flock. He has turned aside my ways and torn me in pieces. He has made me desolate. He has bent his bow and set me up as a target for his arrows. He has caused the arrows of his quiver to pierce my loins. I have become the ridicule of all my people and their taunting song all the day. He has filled me with bitterness. He has made me drink wormwood, which also means bitterness. He has also broken my teeth with gravel and covered me with ashes. This is all probably figurative, but there's, in a literal sense too, the city of Jerusalem was covered with ashes when it burned up. Broken my teeth with gravel might even be a reference to the famine, that after, you know, pure food supplies were gone, they'd eat maybe food that is mixed with sand or whatever, or gravel, that would break their teeth. But it's also entirely possible this is just figurative language and not a reference to those particular things. You have moved my soul far from peace. I have forgotten prosperity. And I said, my strength and my hope have perished from the Lord. Remember my affliction and roaming, my wormwood and my gall. My soul still remembers and sinks within me. This I recall to my mind. Therefore I have hope. Now, at verse 22, which is just about the middle of the book, just about the center, we have an unusually optimistic and positive passage. Whereas the book is entirely made up of laments over destruction and so forth, we have here a bright spot of hope right in the middle of the book, which looks forward to God's restoration and mercies and so forth. He says in verse 22, through the Lord's mercies, we are not consumed, because his compassions do not fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. Now you know where that song comes from. In spite of the appearances to the contrary, God is still merciful, and those who look for him and who are in relationship with him can still find every day evidences of his loving kindness, his mercy, even in the midst of destruction and general devastation of the society around. Individuals can certainly know his mercy, and even the destruction of Jerusalem could be seen as an act of mercy, because it was a discipline that was intended to rid them of the idolatry that would be forever in them and destroying them if he hadn't done it. So even in wrath, he remembers mercy. Even in the judgments of God, those who have faith can recognize the compassion of the Lord. He's faithful to his people. He didn't just leave them. He judged them so that they might change. and not be condemned with the world. The Lord is my portion, says my soul, therefore I hope in Him. The Lord is good to those who wait for Him, to the soul who seeks Him. So, many people in Jerusalem could not claim God had been good to them in the sense that He had wiped them out and their children had starved and been slain in the streets. But those who wait for Him, those that remnants who believed in Him, like Jeremiah himself, could see the goodness of God toward him. After all, he escaped all this. It is good that one should hope and wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. It is good for a man to bear the yoke in his youth. This verse is often quoted, though I'm not sure exactly what it means. It suggests possibly that if a person has to be in slavery, it's better for it to be in his younger years so that he can learn his lessons of humility and hard work and so forth, and it will condition his thinking for the rest of his life. And he may be saying that Jerusalem is like a man who is bearing the yoke now so that it will have a better perspective, more humility later in life. Let him sit alone and keep silent because God has laid it on him. Let him put his mouth in the dust, yet that there may be yet hope, or there may yet be some hope. Let him give his cheek to the one who strikes him and be full of reproach. Now he's basically saying, just receive this command of God. Turn the other cheek, as it were. By the way, in a messianic passage in Isaiah 50 and verse 6, the Messiah says, I gave my cheek to the smiters and did not turn away from him that plucked out the hair, meaning the beard was plucked out. Same kind of language is here. Let him give his cheek to the one who strikes him and be full of reproach. Rather than retaliating, just receive it. Just absorb the judgment and chastisement of the Lord, and hopefully it'll pass. Eventually God will feel like you've absorbed enough, and he'll remove the affliction, is what is implied here. For the Lord will not cast off forever. Though he causes grief, yet he will show compassion according to the multitude of his mercies. For he does not afflict willingly, nor grieve the children of men. That doesn't mean that something happened that was outside of God's will when they got grieved and afflicted. But it means that that's not what what's really in his heart. That's not what his desire is. He doesn't desire to afflict people. He doesn't enjoy the death of the wicked. He sometimes has to do it in order to accomplish his overall will of correcting them, but it's not something that he exactly delights in. To crush under his feet all the prisoners of the earth, to turn aside the justice due to a man before the face of the Most High, or subvert a man in his cause. That's what it's not. God doesn't willingly do that. He doesn't like to do that. The Lord does not approve of those things. Although he has brought those things upon them, it is more or less a secondary measure that he had to bring on them, not what he really would prefer to have done. Their own conduct has required that he treat them this way. Who is he who speaks and it comes to pass when the Lord has not commanded it? Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that woe and well-being proceed? Now the prophet says that both woe and well-being proceed from God. Job said that too. Job said to his wife, shall we receive only good from the Lord and not the evil also? So we need to have room in our theology for a God who brings affliction. A God, it's not just the devil who does that. The devil may in fact be the agent, just as the Babylonians, who were wicked men, were agents that God used to bring affliction on Judah on this occasion. So also when affliction comes to us, the devil himself may be the agent, as he was in the case of Job. But God is the one who decrees it. God is the one who allows it. If God didn't speak it, the devil couldn't do it. And so Jeremiah and Job both have this perspective that woe and well-being both proceed from the mouth of the Lord. That is from God's command and order against it. So, why should a living man complain, a man, for the punishment of his sins? Let us search out and examine our ways and turn back to the Lord. Let us lift our hearts and hands to the God of heaven. Now, he's basically saying what the appropriate response is when God allows affliction in your life. No, don't complain. Receive it as something just, especially if it's chastisement for sins, and use that as an incentive to turn to God. So examine your ways and say, well, why is this happening to me? And then turn to God and repent and return to the God of heaven. And so that's what Jeremiah recommends to his people there. We have transgressed and rebelled. You have not pardoned. You have covered yourself with anger and pursued us, speaking to God this time. You have slain and not pitied. You have covered yourself with a cloud, as mentioned in chapter 2, verse 1, that prayer should not pass through. This time the cloud is not seen as obscuring the light of the sun, the moon, and the stars, but being a barrier between man and God so that the prayers don't reach heaven. If God has put something between himself and the people, and their prayers are not reaching their goal in heaven. You have made us an offscouring and a refuge in the midst of the peoples. By the way, Paul uses the same reference to how the apostles are treated in 1 Corinthians 4:13. 1 Corinthians 4:13, he says, I believe that God has set us apostles as last to live in more humiliation than the average people, and the offscouring and refuge of the world in the midst of peoples. All our enemies have opened their mouths against us. Now, by the way, I should point out that in Judah becoming offscouring and refuge, that's a judgment for her sins. The apostles are made that way, not as a judgment, but simply as a calling. And therefore, what was seen in the Old Testament as something that only happened to people when they did something wrong, in the New Testament is seen as something that people voluntarily take upon themselves when they take positions of responsibility as Christians. They accept the rejection of the world. They accept suffering at the hands of people. It's a very different, kind of thing when the apostles are said to be in this category on the one hand, or when rebellious Israel is. Verse 46, now all of our enemies have opened their mouths against us. Fear and a snare have come upon us. Desolation and destruction. My eyes overflow with rivers of water for the destruction of the daughter of my people. My eyes flow and do not cease without interruption until the Lord from heaven looks down and sees. My eyes bring suffering to my soul because of all the daughters of my city. And that's what I see apparently brings suffering to my soul. And that thing means the tears flowing from my eyes help to influence my soul to experience the proper grief. I'm not sure if that would be the case, although one could read it in the context that way. My enemies, without cause, hunted me down like a bird. Now, here it says, without cause. Here's where I think we must have the prophet speaking for himself instead of for the nation. Because Jerusalem was hunted down, but not without cause. The prophet has already said that the nation was destroyed for good cause, because they offended the Lord, because they did things that brought this rightly upon themselves. However, Jeremiah was personally oppressed without cause. And so we can see, if you'll look at the following verses, that very possibly the prophet is speaking autobiographically here of his own situation. My enemies without cause hunted me down like a bird. They silenced my life in the pit and threw stones at me. The waters flowed over my head. I said, I am cut off. I call on your name, O Lord, from the lowest pit. You have heard my voice. Do not hide your ear from my sign, from my cry of help. This cannot be said of the nation at that point. They had not yet turned to the Lord and cried to the Lord, but Jeremiah, perhaps, in the pit could be said to have done so. You drew near on the day I called on you and said, do not fear. O Lord, you have pleaded the case of my soul. You have redeemed my life. O Lord, you have seen how I am wrong. Judge my case. You have seen all their vengeance, all their schemes against me. You have heard their reproach, O Lord, all their schemes against me, the lips of my enemies, and their whispering against me all the day. Look at their sitting down and their rising up. I am their taunting song. Repay them, O Lord, according to the work of your hands. Give them a veiled heart. Your curse be upon them. In your anger, pursue and destroy them from under the heavens of the Lord. Now, here in verses 64 through 66, we have a fairly typical imprecation. Now, this exact imprecation is not found in the book of Jeremiah, but Jeremiah has occasional imprecations of just this type. As you will recall, going through the book of Jeremiah, there are times when he just breaks into a wish of evil upon the people who have persecuted him. The psalmist, of course, does this as well from time to time. And one of the things he wishes upon them in verse 65 here is that they have a veiled heart. No doubt, immediately your mind is reminded of 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 14 through 16, which says that there is a veil over the hearts of the unbelieving Jews to this day. When Moses is read, there still remains a veil over their hearts, so they can't understand it or see it. And this is a judgment from God. In Romans 11, verses 7 through 8, it talks about how God has given the Jews a spirit of slumbers, eyes that cannot see and ears that cannot hear even unto this day. That is, their hearts have been made hard and numb. Now, that wouldn't be true necessarily of every Jew today, especially those who become Christians. In fact, it says in 2 Corinthians 3, this veil is taken away in the Lord. When one turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. It says.
I don't understand. It seems like Jeremiah is limited to asking the Lord to relent, to take your pain and take it away. And then he goes into this, like, no, don't stop.
I think that, yeah, it's a good point. On one hand, he should refrain from mercy for these people, and then there's an imprecation like this. I think the imprecation is specifically directed toward those who have opposed him. The mercy he asks is for the nation as a whole. But I think in the context, he's talking about how his enemies have persecuted him and resisted his ministry and so forth, and he's not wishing any special mercies on them, but just on the nation. Is that what you're going to say, Sam? Okay, we need to move along here if we're going to work it out. Chapters 4 and 5 are short. The first three chapters have been all equally long and quite long. But these are shorter chapters. Chapter 4 is two-thirds the length of the previous ones, and chapter 5 is one-third the length of the previous ones. So together, chapters 4 and 5 are just as long as each of the other chapters were. How the gold has become dim. How changed the fine gold. The stones of the sanctuary are scattered at the head of every street. There were lovely stones from which the Temple of Solomon had been built, and no doubt gems and gold and so forth, we know were a major part of the architecture. Now it's just been scattered. The temple is just made of rubble. At the head of every street, you'll find bits of the temple and the precious stones and so forth. The precious stones of Zion, valuable as fine gold. He now shifts it to thinking from the literal stones of the temple to the individuals who are precious as gold. The inhabitants of Judah. How are they regarded as clay pots instead of gold? And the work of the hands of the potter, they're treated as if they're worthless, in other words, rather than fine vessels for honor. Even the jackals present their breasts and nurse their young, but the daughter of my people has become cruel like ostriches in the wilderness. The tongue of the infant clings to the roof of its mouth for thirst. The young children ask for bread, but no one breaks it for them. Now, of course, the reason the mothers were not giving food to their children is they didn't have it in the famine. That's what's being referred to. But he says it looks more cruel than even what the animals do. Even jackals, unclean animals, can be expected to show compassion to their young and feed them when they're hungry. But here the people of Israel, God's own people, are cruel, like the ostriches of the wilderness. Of course, ostriches don't nurse their young. And if I knew more about ostriches, I might even be able to tell you some ways they exhibit cruelty. In Job chapter 39, verses 14 through 17, we have a reference also to the behavior of ostriches. Job 39, verses 14 through 17 says, for the speaking, and this talks about the cruelty of the ostrich to her young. Verse 13 actually, the wings of the ostrich wave proudly, but are her wings and pinions like the kindly storks? For she, that is the ostrich, leaves her eggs on the ground and warms them in the dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them, or that a wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly, as though they were not hers. Her labor is in vain, without concern, because God deprives her of wisdom and did not endow her with understanding. So unlike the jackal that has some basic instincts of compassion to feed its infants, the bird-brained ostrich doesn't have enough common sense to even treat its young kindly. And so, in Lamentations, Israel is contrasted unfavorably with an unclean animal like the jackal. The jackal is better and more compassionate toward its young than the Jews are showing themselves to be in the famine. And they're showing themselves to be like the ostrich, the empty-headed ostrich, that God hasn't given any wisdom or understanding, and therefore shows cruelty toward the young. And that is how he describes the mothers depriving their children of food in the famine. Now, this might be partly because the women didn't have food. Obviously, it was because they didn't have an abundance of food. But it may well be that the mothers had some food and ate it themselves rather than giving it to their children. Josephus indicates that happened in 70 A.D. Yes, right?
And why did the
King James version say sea monsters? I don't know. I don't know why the King James says sea monsters there instead of jackals. But certainly, If sea monsters, we understood to be whales. Whales do nurse their young too. And they do bear the breast, as it were, to their young. So it would fit of them if whales be understood to be the sea monsters. But it would seem unlikely that Jeremiah would know even that whales were mammals and that they nursed their young. I mean, I don't think that, you know, biology had progressed so far in his day that they would make an identification of a whale with a mammal instead of a fish. But, you know, I don't know. I must be one of those cases where the Hebrew can be pointed differently and to either read Jackal or Simosin. Okay. Verse 5. Those who ate delicacies are desolate in the streets. Those who were brought up in scarlet embrace ash heaps. That's the people who were rich and lived luxuriously are in the opposite condition now. The punishment of the iniquity of the daughter of my people is greater than the punishment of the sin of Sodom, which was overthrown in a moment with no hand to help her. And it's more merciful, as he'll say a little later too, to die instantly, like the people of Sodom did, than to languish in hunger and die slowly. We see that in verse 9, but we're not there yet. Verse 7. Her Nazarites were brighter than snow and whiter than milk. Of course, Nazarites were the most religious people of society. They took a vow of separation. And they were more ruddy in body than rubies, like sapphire in their appearance. Now their appearance is blacker than soot. They go unrecognized in the streets. Their skin clings to their bones. It has become as dry as wood. Brittle skin from apparently dehydration, lack of water supply during the famine. Those slain by the sword are better off than those who die of hunger. For these pine away, stricken for lack of the fruits of the field. The hands of the compassionate women have cooked their own children. They became food for them in the destruction of the daughter of my people. Another reference to the cannibalism that is faced. The Lord has fulfilled his fury. He has poured out his fierce anger. He kindled a fire in Zion, and it has devoured its fountains. The kings of the earth, by the way, devoured its foundations, excuse me. Probably mean the actual physical foundations of the buildings of the city and the walls. They had to rebuild those, by the way, in the days of Zerubbabel and related foundations. The kings of the earth and the inhabitants of the world would not have believed that the adversary and the enemy could enter the gates of Jerusalem. Jerusalem had such magnificent walls. Even Titus, the Roman who destroyed Jerusalem, indicated that he must have had, he made the statement that we have certainly had God on our side in this endeavor, he said, because what armies or machines of war could have overcome these towers? Jerusalem had powerful walls and towers, and basically no one would have thought it possible to overcome them. And that's what he's saying. The kings of the earth and the inhabitants of the world would not have believed that the adversary and the enemy could enter the gates of Jerusalem, because the sins of her prophets and the iniquities of her priests, who shed in her midst the blood of the just. Now let me just say something here. The walls of a city in those days were their national security, just like military might is the national security of our own culture. We don't have walls around our nation, but we have nuclear walls, as it were, you know, just who would dare to attack us for fear of retaliation from us? And yet, this security is not enough. If God finds the prophets and the priests to be sinful, if he finds innocent blood shed, no amount of earthly security, walls of a city or military might or whatever, none of those things can defend a nation against the wrath and judgment of God. Therefore, the greatest security for a nation, and the thing that will make it last longest, is not to have the largest walls or the largest military, but to have the most righteous population. And that is why, when people sometimes accuse Mennonites and other pacifist Christians of not being willing to defend their country when they take advantage of the benefits of this country, it is a false accusation. The fact of the matter is the Christian church, in promoting righteousness in society, is doing far more to preserve the country than those who go and serve in its military interests, or who do anything to preserve it in through carnal security. You see, the church is the salt of the earth. It is the preservative of a society. And if the salt loses its savor, eventually that society is without salt and without redeeming value, and eventually God just removes it. And so, here also, it is celebrated that Jerusalem's walls had been the marvel of nations, and people, thought, well, no one could ever beat that country. But, he says in verse 13, because the sins of her prophets and the iniquities of her priests who shed in her midst the blood of the just, that's why they fell, despite their walls. God saw occasion to destroy them. And when God has put had in his heart to judge a nation, no amount of earthly securities can change that. the shedding of the blood is just, for most of us in our own society, be analogous to, or not analogous to, but the same thing as what we have in abortion. Our culture does not yet tolerate outright murder on the streets, but it, although it's fairly light on penalties of murders, but it condones outright the murder of innocents. They wandered blind in the streets. They have defiled themselves with blood so that no one would touch their garments. They cried out to them, "Go away, unclean! Go away, unclean! Do not touch us." When they fled and wandered, those among the nations said, "They shall no longer dwell here. The faithful Lord scattered them. He no longer regards them. The people do not respect the priests nor show favor to the elders." It's an interesting thing when the religious leaders begin to compromise and get into sin. They often do so that they won't seem too aloof. They won't seem too holier than thou. They don't want to come off as overly pious or puritanical. They want, they usually make their compromise in order to please the world and to obtain respect and acceptance in the world. That's the main reason that the clergy usually, start to champion things like